every suitable want ad. She tried not to wince. Suitable. She'd heard that before. 18 years later, and he was still trying to get started. Such a waste. He smelled of old spice. His face was fuller, his eyes healthily bright, his grin as quick and boyish as ever. His hair was just turning gray, though not as much as hers, and she was 12 years younger.
"So how are the kids?"
he finally asked, mouth twitching either with nerves or guilt. Probably both, she thought now as she told him. Alice had gotten really friendly with that new young priest, Father Gannon, so in a way she was glad Alice would be leaving for school soon, because sometimes she was afraid Alice might choose the religious life. She'd almost said the easy way out. "Wouldn't that be something?" Sam said, smiling. "Especially under the circumstances." She looked at him. Circumstances. Surely he didn't mean that the way it sounded. "Imagine," he said, "their little girl, a nun." No, that would be terrible, she told him. That wasn't at all the life she wanted for Alice.
"Don't you think that's up to Alice?"
he said, and again she bit her tongue. Such wisdom from a grown man still bound to his mother. Had it been a life he had chosen? Yes. Yes, she had no doubt of it. Chosen, whether through decision or indecision, but still a choice, to do or to let happen. Just as all these years he'd known there was something his mother had done to take care of him, to protect him as well from the world as from his sister's whim and anger. But by not asking, he had chosen the blameless realm of ignorance in which he could dwell powerless as a child. The late afternoon sun glared on the windshield as she turned onto West Street. When she'd called to say she needed to talk to him, he'd wanted to come to the house, but she never knew when Omar might pop in, and going to Helen's was out of the question, so she'd suggested they ride around town. She took a left turn at the fruit market, amused to see his foot tense for a break. He had taught her to drive. There had only been her father's truck, so Sam used to take her far out into the country in the brand-new Chrysler his mother had bought for him when he and Nora Cushing got engaged. She began by sitting close and steering while he worked the pedals. She glanced over at him now, remembering the good times in those few months between their first meeting and their wedding. No, not their wedding. That would have been Nora Cushing's event. Hers, theirs, had been a formality. A dour priest and the two witnesses, one a friend of Sam's, a red-eyed man in a rumpled suit who kept calling her Nora. One drinking buddy doing another a favor, she'd come to realize. Her witness had been her younger cousin, who burst into tears when Sam told her to stop giggling. Without planning to come this way, she was driving past Bridget's 3 run-down tenements. Built 80 years ago for quarry workers, they were home now to some of the town's poorest people. Knotted curtains dangled from open, unscreened windows. The roof on one of the front porches sagged in the middle. While news of the trust had not seemed to surprise Sam, hearing that his mother had willed his children these hovels gave him obvious pleasure. He leaned forward to peer up at the curled roof shingles.
All these years Helen's been sucking money out of these dumps and never putting a penny back, and now I know why. God, the thought of it must kill her. No wonder she hates me. Once Mother dies, she's got nothing. Nothing.
He shook his head in bewilderment.
Not even the house.
Chuckling, he rubbed his chin.
Let me see now. I wonder how much rent I should charge Helen and Renee.
Even though she knew he was trying to amuse her, the thought of Renee, Helen, and Sam living together for the rest of their lives was as depressing as it was likely.
I'm sure Bridget's taken care of Helen in ways that don't need a will. Her bank accounts are probably all in Helen's name. I'll bet they've been that way for years.
She thought of the bank book being slipped under her door. $10,000 her mother-in-law had offered if she'd only take Sam back. He was pinching the frayed crease on his knee. He said he hadn't called the kids yet because this time he wanted things to be different. No false hope, no big burst and then the fizzle. This time he had to start with himself.
I have to do it for me first. Do you know what I mean, Pet?
Pet, the old ache. No matter how long ago or far away, he was the first and only man she had ever loved until... No, she dared not even think it. Omar was starting to scare her, all his promises and disappearances, and the other night, his cold refusal when she demanded her money back. Was it Sam in another form? Was she one of those women who needed to be hurt in order to feel loved? She pulled up to the curb. She would get this over with.
I can't keep letting them down, he was saying. You know, after Alice came to see me in the hospital, I was so depressed I couldn't get out of bed for 3 days. Her head whipped around. She said she was in the waiting room most of the time. How did he do this? How did he always manage to make it their fault? He sighed.
You want to know the truth? I almost didn't go down. I couldn't face her. I mean, ruining her graduation was bad enough, but here she is, a beautiful young woman, and she has to come to a place like that to see her father.
His voice broke.
She looks just like you. You weren't much older than that when we met.
He put his hand on her shoulder, squeezing until it hurt. They both stared straight ahead. There were no words for that kind of loss, she thought. It never went away. The thing had been, whatever was left, was as much a presence, as molecular, as organic, as the children they had created. Yes, time helped, and yet even a word, a smell, the creak of the darkened bed in the night could still bring it all back. Time helped in the bearing, the enduring, the hauling of it from crisis to crisis.
Jesus,
he said, rubbing his eyes. I don't know how you've hung in there all this time, pet. The kids, she said against the lump in her throat. They keep me going. They're good kids. They really are. She took a deep breath to keep from crying.
I've certainly screwed things up to a fairly well, haven't I?
He sighed bitterly.
But I swear, pet, I'm going to make it all up to you and the kids. He groaned. All the shit I've given you. Oh, God. I can't even think of it. I can't believe it. I wake up sometimes in the middle of the night and I lie there with my eyes open thinking. So, where's my life? What'd I do with it? How did it all get this bad?
Well, that's a start, isn't it, Sam?
I don't know. I don't know how many more starts I have left in me, to tell the truth. I'm really scraping the bottom of the barrel, pet.
You're feeling sorry for yourself, Sam. I'm sorry, but that's what you're doing. She tried to fight this surging anger.
No, you're right. It's always this way. After all the promises and all the best intentions and fighting it off minute by minute, day by day, same thing happens. It starts feeling like I'm banging my head against the wall. No matter how hard I try, I just can't put anything together. I get just so far, and this voice starts in my head. S.O.S. S.O.S. Same old shit. Same old shit. It's this twisted cynicism. Me that can't believe me. I get up early, I shave and get dressed, and I say, okay, this is the day. Today you're going to find a job. You're going to call your wife and kids. You're going to get things straight for once. And then the voice starts. Oh, yeah, 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 same old shit. And that's about as fucking far as it gets.
He gave a bitter laugh.
Me, standing in front of the door all dressed up and shaved, trying to work up enough courage to turn the knob.
He looked at her.
Just to turn the knob, pet.
He whispered, eyes wide with disbelief.
I can't even do that.
Yes, you can. Of course you can. Oh, Sam, you're just so used to hiding out you don't know where to begin. Damn it. Damn it, Sam. Sometimes I look at the kids, especially Benji, and I get so scared. I'm afraid if I let up for even a minute, they'll quit. They'll give up. They'll spend the rest of their lives taking the easy way out.
Yeah. Just like dear old Dad.
That's not what I meant, she lied. I'm talking about pushing yourself. I'm talking about putting your hand on the doorknob and turning it, Sam. What I mean is, I make sure the kids do that. No one ever made you do that, Sam. He looked out at the street and smiled.
Being married to you, pet, was the happiest time in my life.
My God. All she remembered of it was tears and overturned chairs, broken windows, broken promises.
The one thing that keeps me going, and damn it, I vowed I wasn't going to say this, but I want you to know, pet, I'm going to put this all back together. I swear I am. I'm going to make you love me again, Marie. I am.
Poor Sam. Was that all he had to cling to? She sat with her eyes closed. She didn't want to feel anything right now, not for him or any man.
You know, I may be a dumb son of a bitch, but I'm a lucky one. In what was probably the biggest foul-up of my life, I ended up with you and the kids. I was telling the hospital shrink how I was supposed to marry Nora Cushing and how it was probably the smartest move I'd ever made. And then I told him what happened, how I started sneaking around after you, even though I knew it was crazy.
You were so young, and there I was, 30 years old, with the biggest wedding in town, planned to the richest girl in town. And you know what he told me? He said I couldn't stand the certainty and the deliberateness of success. He said I didn't think I was good enough. And so, instead of facing what I didn't think I deserved, I found a way to foul myself, to ruin everything, in Nora's eyes and in my mother's eyes.
Tears ran down his cheeks now. He shook out his handkerchief and blew his nose.
Oh, Pet, he sobbed.
You bastard, she said, starting the car and shifting into gear.
You no-good bastard, she said, over the roar of the engine as they lurched around the corner. Pet, he called, reaching toward her. Pet,
well, the dirt you stepped in 18 years ago is still here, like it or not. You've never done anything for those kids, but this time you're going to, damn it. Alice may be nothing more to you than a disgusting, shameful mistake that ruined your whole life, but now you're finally going to have to pay for that. I want half that trust. Do you hear me, Sam? I want $5,000, and I want it right now. Those shitty tenements aren't doing my kids any good right now. And right now, damn it, is when we need the help.
All the way back to Bridget's, his voice rose over hers, trying to explain. She'd misunderstood. What he'd meant was that she and the kids were the best, the finest part of his life. They were everything to him, everything.
Then you tell Helen that, she said, and then tell her this for me. Tell her I'm taking you both to court, and when I'm done, those kids will have everything they deserve. This house and every penny you and your miserly sister have ever hidden away.
You've got to listen, Pat, please, he begged when she stopped the car.
No, no, I don't. Do you know how many times I've heard that when you were roaring drunk? But for you to sit there cold sober and say that to me, ah, who the hell do you think you are?
A piece of shit, he said in a low voice. A no-good piece of shit.
Well, you're right there, Sam. Now get out!
As she drove off, she refused to look in the rearview mirror and see his stooped figure in the pathetic jacket dragging up the stairs of that miserable house.
When would she learn? He deserved no pity. None. He had spoken the truth. Skinny arms and legs, with her baby belly bulging against her cheap cotton dress, she had been his masterstroke, the cruelest blow he could wield against those determined to love him, determined to save him.
Is your dear mother home?
Trumpeted Omar Duval as he hurried into the house. For the past 3 days he hadn't come or called. Benji waited for Norm to answer, because that was who Omar was staring at.
I said, is your mother home?
Nope,
Norm grunted, without looking up from the newspaper. He had been reading aloud the latest report on Joey Selden, who was still in the hospital with a fractured skull.
Do you know when she'll be back?
Omar asked with a hopeful glance at the cold, potless stove.
Nope.
Do you know where she went?
His tone grew strained.
Yeah,
Norm glanced over the paper.
She's with my father. I'll tell her you were here.
Omar smiled, obviously pleased to hear this.
Save you the trouble, son. I'll wait.
He pulled out a chair and settled down in a sigh of sweaty cloth and flesh. His face flushed, Norm turned the pages.
So what's new, Benji?
Omar asked. He removed a toothpick from his breast pocket and began to clean his teeth in a delicate whittling motion, sucking the toothpick clean after every couple of teeth.
Not much, Benji shrugged, trying to hide his relief from Norm. With Omar here, their mother would be in a good mood again. Things would be better tonight, he thought,
then shuddered, remembering his dream of that bloated body swelling in the damp heat until it finally exploded, its volcanic spew raining entrails and blobs of flesh over all the streets and houses. He'd knelt on his bed, watching the bloody mess slide down the window glass. They said he'd been screaming. He only remembered crying.
Well, it's certainly been a busy week for me, if not a profitable one,
Omar was saying. He'd been on the road most of the time, trying to establish franchises in some of the more rural parts of the state. His target group had been farm families. The party marketing concept had great appeal for such isolated women.
Speaking of which,
Norm interrupted,
where have you been staying?
Omar looked right at him.
What do you mean, speaking of which? What exactly are you asking me, Norman?
I asked you where you've been staying.
The corners of Norm's mouth flicked.
That's all.
Kinda here and there. I've been on the road so damn much.
he said with such a derisive snort his nose leaked. He groped in his pockets for a handkerchief. Benji's eyes widened. He thought Norm would surely laugh, but every feature was rigid as stone.
I see your car down in back of the fruit store a lot, Norm said.
Omar made a face.
The fruit store?
He asked incredulously.
Yeah, I drive my foreman there to get his paper. I see your car out back.
My car?
Omar frowned and shook his head.
42695, that's your plate number, right?
Omar glanced at Benji and laughed.
Tell the truth, I don't even know what my name is half the time.
Yeah, I'll bet you don't,
Norm muttered.
Come again?
Omar leaned across the table.
What'd you say?
Benji's eyes darted between them. Stop it, stop it, stop it, he wanted to shout. Why did Norm always have to stir things up?
You heard me,
Norm said each time Omar insisted he repeat what he'd said.
You are pushing me, you hear me, boy? You are trying my patience, and I am sick and tired of it,
Omar snarled, the undulating cadence so swiftly perilous that Benji gripped the chair seat.
Does my mother know you're living with Bernadette Mansaw? Norm asked.
Omar's chest rose and fell with panting.
Your mother knows Miss Mansaw is one of my investors, but what she doesn't know is about you and your friends terrifying that young woman, and in the process daring to bandy about my good name, slandering me. That's what your mother doesn't know. But maybe she should. Maybe I shouldn't protect you anymore, boy. Seems to me you're on a downhill slide anyway, drinking and brawling and killing an innocent creature in the process.
You asshole!
Norm cried, running at Omar, who only had time to raise his hands.
Norm!
Benji shouted. Omar ducked as Norm swung. He grabbed Norm's arm and yanked him off balance.
Please, Norm!
Benji yelled as Norm rushed at Omar again. Omar was on his feet now. He raised his hands, palms inward, like a priest's silent prayer during Mass. He stared at Norm with a rapture that might have been pleasure but for the quivering, bloodless mouth.
Come on!
Norm said.
Norm!
Benji grabbed his brother's shirt and tried to pull him back, a futile gesture against Norm's straining chest and arms. But not strong enough, Benji knew, remembering Early's wide back and thick arms.
Please don't, Norm, please!
He cried, unable to contain the horror. The kitchen shook with the familiar rumble of their mother's car pulling into the driveway. Their hands fell to their sides. She raced inside, too agitated to notice the breathless strain between them. She tossed her purse onto the table.
Oh,
she said with a glance at Omar. How good to see you back.
I know. It's been one hell of a week,
he said, ignoring her sarcasm.
But hotter on you than me, I'm sure,
he added quickly, reaching to touch her arm, but she darted away. He watched her rummage loudly through the cupboard for a pan.
So how'd it go with Sam?
She stood at the sink, filling the pan with water.
He knew about it, she said in a high, thin voice. Of course, he says he didn't really know, that he wasn't sure just how much it was. But he knew, I could tell. All this time, when I never knew where our next dime was coming from, he's been sitting on his nest egg.
She put the pan on the burner and looked back at Norm, posted in the doorway, watching Omar.
You could have at least set the table, she said to Norm. Is that too much to expect?
No sooner said than done,
Omar said, sliding the plates from the shelf.
The boys had a long day.
Oh, really?
Her voice trembled.
You want to hear what a long day is? I'll tell you.
She was grabbing bowls of sauce, lettuce, and a cucumber from the refrigerator and banging them down on the table.
I've had it. I'm not fooling around anymore, I told him. He's got a week, 1 week, and then I'll sue them all. Him,
she vowed, tearing the lettuce into chunks.
His mother, his sister, Renee, the whole goddamn warped bunch of them.
Norm had gone to his room. Benji turned on the television. Omar stayed in the kitchen, helping her cook and set the table, soothing her, finally making her laugh, softening her voice, whispering that he loved her, that he needed her so badly he was on fire inside. After lying awake for hours, Benji had made up his mind. To continue this way was too dangerous. He waited in the heat in his narrow room until the rest of the house lay dark and soundless. He opened the door, listened, then tiptoed down the stairs to the couch, where Omar slept on his side, his naked back exposed, the rolls of flesh at his waist pale in the streetlight that shone through the open window. His shoes were on the floor, his suit and shirt draped over the chair. He did not snore, but wheezed the high end of it like a whimper. Benji stood by the couch, certain of his decision, but still not sure just how to handle it. He'd never go to the police. He couldn't confide in Alice or Norm, because they'd tell their mother, and she was the one person who could not know. He'd do anything to ensure her happiness, because only then could they be safe. Each clash between Norm and Omar stripped away another layer. He was afraid that soon there'd be nothing left. This would be his only chance. Days might go by before he saw Omar again or could be alone with him. He touched Omar's shoulder. It felt warm and damp and bonelessly soft. Omar turned with a grunt, then sat up suddenly, feet flat on the floor, his head jerking back and forth as he struggled to focus through the darkness.
"What is it?"
he demanded in a frightened voice. "It's me, Omar. Benji. I have to tell you something," he whispered.
"What? What do you have to tell me?"
he sighed, leaning his head back on the couch.
"What did you have, a bad dream or something?"
he asked, yawning when Benji did not immediately answer.
"Your mother said you had another bad dream last night. Everything's okay, so why don't you just go back up to bed now?"
He'd been trying to speak, but it wasn't words he needed to express as much as the wrenching force of this skirmish between his heart and his head.
"I'm beat, Benji. Really, really beat."
He started to lie down. "Omar, I was there that day," he whispered, stepping closer now. "I saw you. I saw you in that early fighting. He chased you, and then you were, I think, wrestling. And then there was this sharp thing, shiny like a knife, in both your hands. And he looked up, and I think he saw me because he kind of stopped a minute. And you took off then. He ran after you, and I ran home."
There was a long moment of silence. "My Lord," Omar sighed, stretching his arms back behind his head. "So someone does know the truth I speak. This comes as a great relief to me, Benji, a great, great relief. That young man you saw didn't just rob me of my money. He took away my goodwill and my trust in my fellow man and my self-confidence. I tell you, if it weren't for your mother, I don't know. I hate to think where I'd be right now."
He slapped his knee.
"Well, be that as it may, you need your sleep more'n you need any more of my moaning and groaning. I just hope to God Early doesn't harm anyone else like he did me."
"Omar, he's dead. His body's right out there in those woods. I saw it. The Klubok dog kept bringing back pieces of his clothes. He's all swollen up, and there's a knife in his chest. A knife with a snakeskin handle." Omar buried his face in his hands.
"Oh, my God," he groaned. "This can't be. That poor misguided creature. I wonder what happened."
"You killed him," Benji said, as if the question needed answering. Omar's head shot up.
"Tell me you're pranking me, Benji. Please tell me."
"You did. I know you did, but..."
"You know what? Oh, my God, your mother's right to be worried about your state of mind. Now you listen to me."
He was stepping into his pants, his shoes, reaching for his shirt.
"We have to talk, and we can't be waking everyone up, so you come outside with me."
"No." Dressed, Omar filled the room, the night, with whiteness.
"What? You're not afraid of me now, are you?"
"No." And he knew he wasn't. He was afraid that one of these times Omar might do to Norm what he had done to Early, and he was afraid that if Omar left them, it would be the end for his mother. But he wasn't afraid that Omar would hurt him. Whatever had happened that day had been done in panic, in fear, in anger. Of that he had no doubt.
"Come with me. We have to talk."
Omar opened the door.
"We'll stay on the street."
As they headed toward Main Street, he kept hobbling with the little stones underfoot. Omar was quiet. Benji was amazed to hear himself talk so much. The words had been lodged in him for too long. All he really wanted, he tried to explain, was his mother's happiness. Nothing else was as important as that.
"I couldn't agree more," Omar said.
"She likes you," he said before Omar could say more. "Sometimes she cries when you don't come." Omar sighed.
"It hurts to hear that, and it's far more devotion than I deserve. Tell me, Benji."
He stopped walking. They were almost at the corner.
"Who else knows this about poor Early?"
"Nobody."
"Not Norm or Alice?"
Benji shook his head.
"And not your mother?"
"No."
"Why?
Why not tell someone? That's a terrible burden to bear alone.
He tried to explain that the more terrible burden was his mother's pain. Early was dead, and nothing and no one could change that now. He couldn't adequately express what he felt, but he tried. Somehow, in the midst of all this chaos, there had to be room for love. Yes, Early was dead, but he couldn't let that death destroy his mother as well. Evil might be a force here, but then so was love, because without it, nothing made sense or would survive. Just as he couldn't hate his father for his affliction and the pain it caused, so he was incapable of condemning Omar for Early's death.
But I didn't kill him. He must have fallen on his knife.
They said it was your knife. He reminded Omar that he had sent him to talk to the two men.
Liars, the two of them, armed to the teeth with knives and pistols every minute I knew them. What else did they say?
I can't remember, he said as they started back. He would not mention the silver money clip thick with bills. There seemed no point to it, not now anyway. Omar was right. It had been a terrible burden, and now, with it shifted to Omar, he felt relieved. If Omar chose to, he could call the police and tell his side of it. What mattered most was that everything work out between his mother and Omar. And now he knew Norm would be safe with the line, the secret of Early's body, too broadly and plainly drawn for Omar to breach.
But you see, we can't believe everything we're told,
Omar said as they walked along.
Nothing's the way it seems anymore. The world's too full of cruelty. People lie. They say terrible things. Sometimes the only truth we can know is what we feel in here, he said, touching his chest. Benji, you have to believe me,
Omar whispered, pausing in front of the house.
I did not kill Early.
When he didn't respond, Omar clamped his hand over his shoulder.
If that's what you think, then I can't go back in there. I'll just leave. I'll go now, tonight, and in the morning you can tell your mother.
Omar stared at him for a long, expectant moment, and then he turned. Benji watched him grow shapeless and blurred in the distant streetlight before he ran after him, calling softly,
Wait! Wait! I'm not going to tell my mother! I don't want her to know!
Then you have to believe me, Omar cried. You have to! It's the only way I can stay, don't you see?
Benji nodded, confused by the sudden parry, the shifting ground, the trembling underfoot. He was just a boy. He was only 12. There was so much he did not know.
I'll tell you what killed Early Jones. It was avarice and lust, selfishness and dishonesty, treachery. That's what killed Early Jones, not me.
Do you understand? Don't you know what must have happened?
He took my money and he started to run. He was trying to get back to the other two who were waiting for him with my car, my clothes, my goods, all my possessions. And so he's running and huffing and puffing when all of a sudden his foot gets snagged in something. Who knows? Maybe a vine or a tree root. Or maybe he just trips. But down he goes, flat on his face, and the knife, the blade he still carried against me, jams up into his heart.
Omar sighed. Eyes closed, he shook his head.
I just hope he went quickly, that's all.
Yeah,
Benji said, as oddly breathless as if he'd just been sprinting through those spring woods.
I hope so, too.
They went inside, quickly, quietly, feeling their way through the dark, each bound by the other's vision. A rainstorm broke over the mountains, the sudden downpour swelling rivulets into foamy, gushing brooks. Gusts of wind lashed spindly trees back and forth, bending them to the ground. On the third floor of Atkinson Hospital, Nurse Anne-Marie Simrose moved quickly through the sleeping ward. There were 8 patients, all men, and most of these were elderly. She had 3 more meds to administer before her break. The windows flashed with the brilliance of the lightning. The thunderclaps seemed to come every few seconds now. It was amazing how soundly everyone slept through the storm, especially the older men, who usually tossed and turned all night with insomnia. This was a phenomenon she'd noticed before.
Mr. Selden,
she whispered, bending over the old popcorn vendor whose head was still bandaged. Tomorrow his sutures would be removed. The blow had fractured his skull, and for 3 days he'd lain in a coma. Sonny Stoner had visited every day. A distant cousin had driven down from Burlington to find a nursing home that would care for him when, and if, his doctor interjected, he was released. But Joey Selden had come out of the coma. He insisted he was going home, and as soon as he could, back to his stand.
"Mr. Selden," Nurse Simrose whispered, the grays of her fingertips on his shoulder, surely icy, she thought, as his eyes opened with alarm. "I have your pills here," she said, lifting him and bringing the cup to his lips. He swallowed, his sightless eyes locked on hers, even now as she eased him back onto the pillow. "Good night," she whispered, then turned to go. She glanced back. A bolt of lightning filled the ward with light, and Joey Selden's eyes flew from window to window. It was the brightness, she told herself. That was all. Just the sudden intensity. Almost a mile away in his apartment over the Holy Articles shop, Howard Menke was wide awake. Usually storms like this frightened him, but he was so excited over tomorrow's trip that he could think of little else. First thing in the morning, he and his landlady, Lucille, were leaving on the bus to see Cousin Perda. He'd packed their lunch, 4 liverwurst and tomato sandwiches, 2 hard-boiled eggs, 2 devil dogs, and a thermos of cherry Kool-Aid. He turned on the light next to his bed once again to admire the gifts he had bought for Perda and the other patients. There were 2 red and black Japanese fans, a magnifying glass, a box of gold stars, 6 tiny plastic infants swaddled in bits of pink and blue flannel, and his favorite, the tumbling man in the squeeze bars. He squeezed the bright green sticks, smiling as the little figures spun and turned up and over the sticks, then down again. He couldn't wait to show Lucille how to work it. Maybe it would make her laugh. It was hard to make Lucille laugh. Lucille was bringing holy cards. She'd wanted to give each patient a patron saint card, but the only name he could remember was his cousin's, and Lucille said there was no such saint as Perda, so she decided on the Sacred Heart of Jesus. "Good idea," he said, but the truth was that the image of Jesus holding his bleeding heart always made him sick to his stomach and dizzy because of the way he couldn't stop thinking about that soft, warm heart still beating as it bled in the palm of your hand. And the whole time, like now that he'd let it into his thoughts, he'd be trying to click it off, think of something else. "Come on now," he'd tell himself, "anything but that," even though Josiah said it wasn't like a human heart, of course. A human heart would die outside the body, but Jesus' heart was eternal, didn't need a cord or any connecting thing to keep him alive, just love, she said. That was it, love. Think of love, just love, love, love. And Lucille, whom he loved, 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 but dared not tell because of the man who came sometimes. He was older, short and plump, with gray sideburns. He always brought her apples and pears. The last time, after he left, Howard heard Lucille singing through the heat register on the floor where he'd been lying and listening the whole time. Tomorrow, after the trip to see Perda, he was going to tell her, maybe even on the way home in the dark bus, when they'd both be tired and feeling good about themselves, and lucky, the way he and Josiah used to feel, in their realization not only of all they had, but that they had each other. Of course, now that his sister was under the spell of Grandine Carson, she considered the trip to see Perda nothing but a waste of time and money. But not Lucille. She had said yes the minute he asked her. All through the storm, Chief Stoner had been dozing in the chair by his wife's bed. He woke up now, startled by the sudden quiet, the wet stillness, and the close scent of flowers in the room. He listened. When he heard her breathing, he gripped the arms of the chair and started to get up.
"Sonny," Carol said, "where are you going?"
"Nowhere,"
he lied. The flowers on the dresser were from Eunice. She sent dinner over every night, and on Sundays, when the nurse was off, she bathed Carol and spent the day with her. Sonny made it a point to be away from here on Sundays. On the night of Joey Selden's attack, he'd vowed to stop seeing Eunice. He'd called his sister in Rhode Island and asked if Lester could spend a few weeks with her. She had 6 kids, all athletes, but Lester had refused to go, preferring to spend his nights down in the kitchen, monitoring police calls. He'd given up suggesting he call Alice Vermoyle. Lester said the world was becoming an evil place.
"Lay down with me," Carol said. "Please."
"But I don't want to hurt you," he said.
"Nothing hurts anymore,"
she sighed through the swoon of her medication. Buckles, badges, and keychains clinking, he lay on his side facing her, cringing to keep every pore, every bone, hair, and muscle from touching her. They hadn't been this close in months.
"How's that?"
he whispered. And when she didn't answer, he asked again, hardly knew what to say anymore.
"I'm sorry this is taking so long," she said.
"You sleep so much during the day, it's hard at night," he said.
"I didn't mean that," she said, and he realized she was crying.
"Oh, Carol, don't. Oh, please don't."
"No, listen. This is important, Sonny."
As she spoke, he tried to let his mind wander. He had 3 patrolmen assigned downtown tonight, 2 on foot and 1 in the car. If that didn't work. Her sadness tore him apart.
"You see, I know everything," she was saying. "That's what happens. Part of me's way up there, the good part."
"No, the good part's here," he whispered, taking her small, hard hand in both of his.
"Now you just listen. I know how sad you are. You don't think you're a good man anymore, do you? But you are. You are. I know you are."
"No, I'm not,"
he said as he moved closer, holding her hand to his mouth. And now it all came out. His carelessness at work, his men's disappointment in him. Another store had been broken into since Joey Selden's mugging, Hardy's Records, and though he was certain that punk Mooney was involved, he couldn't seem to prove it. There was some malevolence in the air, a heaviness he could smell and taste. He woke up dreading it and fell asleep dreading it.
"But it's not your fault, Sonny."
"Yes, it is," he said. "Things just stopped being important anymore."
"What things?"
she whispered across the pillow.
"I don't know," he thought a minute. "Rules, I guess. Seemed like being careful didn't matter anymore. All that time and always trying to keep one step ahead, you know. And what the hell? Look what happens."
She didn't say anything. He heard the catch in her breathing.
"You don't mean me, do you, Sonny?"
"Of course I mean you. What do you think I mean?"
"Eunice, that's what you mean."
They lay in silence. He stared at the ceiling. He needed to tell how Eunice had pursued and seduced him, how by taking advantage of his grief she had betrayed her sister-in-law, her closest friend. For the first time now he realized how much he hated her. Women like that left their poison everywhere.
"She always made sure she was right there, right ready and available,"
he began. But she stopped him. She didn't have the energy for it. What she meant by part of her already being up there was that she saw things differently now.
"At first, it hurt real, real bad. But then I tried to stop caring because I couldn't do both. I couldn't hate the two of you and still die. The hate was keeping me alive."
She touched his cheek.
"And besides, now, in a way, I'm relieved. I don't have to worry so much about you and Les being alone. I can just concentrate on this."
"This?"
But he knew what she meant.
"I just want to go now. I could, you know, honey. I could do it tonight, if I wanted."
"What do you mean?"
he cried. He jumped up and turned on the light. She cringed away from its glare. He pulled open the nightstand drawer, then all the dresser drawers. He was looking for bottles. She had pills hidden somewhere. Pills or poison, that's what she meant. He picked up the bottle of Lysol from the windowsill and peered at the label. He searched through her closet, repelled by the stale odor of her unworn clothes in the airless heat.
"Don't, Sonny, please don't,"
she kept saying as he rummaged through the shoe boxes on the top shelf. Letters, photos, dried corsages whose brittle, rusty petals crumbled when he touched them.
"You can't do that,"
he said, fumbling in her bureau drawers through lace panties, silk slips, garter belts, and stockings she would never wear again. He kicked aside the scatter rug and ran his hand under the dresser. This was a familiar roll. He took the chintz cushion from the rocker, unzipped it, and felt inside. He knew exactly what to do here. Many's the time he had conducted similar searches, looking for money, a gun, some evidence of malfeasance, in this case the damning proof of his own sins. In failing his family and his community, he had failed himself.
"Sonny, please stop. You think you can control everything, but you can't."
He stood in the middle of the room, looking around. It was in here somewhere, mocking him. Here, under his own roof, it had spread, tainting them. But he would not be that easily defeated this time. He would fight back, and he would keep on fighting, protecting what was his. She held up her hand as he stepped closer. The lamp lit her face with a penetrating luminosity, the bones glowing through her flat white pallor.
"Don't, please don't,"
she whispered as he stuck his hand under the mattress. He pulled out three wax paper sandwich bags filled with capsules and tablets. She begged him to put them back. They were all she had, didn't he understand? Just knowing they were there was often comfort, strength enough. This was wrong. He had no right to take this from her. If he really loved her, he would at least allow her this one last choice she could make for herself. Didn't he understand how much she needed this final freedom? No, he protested. Not freedom, but despair. To do this would make a mockery of her life.
"Of your life, you mean?"
she sobbed as he went across the hall. He emptied the bags into the toilet and pressed the lever, watching the swirl of colored pills gurgle safely away down and out through the sewer pipes under the wide, rain-soaked front lawn to the road, deep below the street, all the streets, safely, safely away. The rain had turned to drizzle, the lightning sporadic and distant. The faint rumble of thunder came like the weary aftermath to a wild party. Chairs pushed into place, a couch dragged back, rugs rolled out. Smiling, Astrid Haddad lay in bed with her hands clasped behind her head. Beside her, Bob slept soundly. He'd just invested a lot of money in a business tailor-made for her show business background. The minute Bob said the name Omar, she recognized it as that mysterious guy Marie Fermoil knew, but would never talk about. He'd come into Bob's office and sold him a franchise in a business Bob said would more than double the money she made now. When she thought of poor Marie struggling to make ends meet, she realized how lucky she was to have sweet Bobby Haddad. He'd stood behind her last night, smiling as she removed her makeup. Then he'd tossed the certificate of franchise onto her dressing table and told her to quit both jobs in the morning. Don't even worry about giving notice. This was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, the merchandising wave of the future. Imagine getting paid for giving parties. It would be like Vegas in a way. Balloons, she thought, picturing the ceiling a mass of white balloons floating like soap suds. Her color scheme would be pink, silver, and white. She saw herself on a little platform in one of her shimmering cocktail dresses. She'd open every party with a song.
"Bobby, wake up,"
she whispered, nudging him. His eyes opened heavily, and he curled his bandaged hands to his chest.
"Listen to what I just made up."
She'd forgotten about his hands, but she wanted him to hear this before she forgot. She leaned over him, singing in a husky whisper.
"Don't you ladies just sit and mope? Sparkle up your lives with Presto soap."
He fell back to sleep, smiling. There was so much to do, she couldn't tell anyone. Omar Duval had told Bob they should keep it to themselves for a while. First she'd call Mr. Briscoe in the morning and tell him she was through. She sighed, relieved that she wouldn't have to spend every day afraid of seeing Norm Fermoil. She looked over at Bobby, ashamed now of all her fooling around. The poor guy had worked his hump off to do this for her, out every night lately, and coming in so tired sometimes he trembled and cried out in his sleep. Tonight he'd come home not only soaking wet, but with bleeding hands. He'd cut them on the old metal desk that he'd been moving to make room for her Presto soap material. With her first profits from the soap business, she'd surprise Bobby with a brand new executive mahogany desk like her boss at the casino had. It was almost 3 in the morning. Omar dozed on the couch until the front door creaked open and Alice tiptoed inside. He watched her shadow pass over him. No doubt of what she'd been up to, he thought, grinning as her door closed upstairs. He waited until the only sound in the house was the drip of the kitchen faucet. Then he crept up the stairs and opened Marie's door. She reached up to stroke his arm as he unbuckled his pants and let them drop to the floor. She lifted the sheet. The minute he crawled in, her legs scissored around him.
"Oh, you woman," he moaned.
"Shh,"
she panted in his ear as he rolled on top of her. She kept imploring him. The certainty of Early's death had spawned this amazing passion. At first he'd thought it was fear, which in his younger years had always been a galvanizing force. but now, with all that blind energy turned inward, his course was no longer set by that frenetic voice in his head telling him to run, but by desire, and all that he desired was here. He understood now that this had been the mission. All his life he had been headed here, to success and the love of a strong woman. Benji wanted his mother's happiness more than anything else, so Omar knew the boy would not betray him, if betray was even the proper word, because truly he could not even now recall the actual moment, the blow, the thrust, if there had been one. For how could so pure a heart have taken a life? Impossible. He could not comprehend such an act in the face of this desire. No, 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 came the rhythmic pounding of his heart over hers, because he would have this, have this, have this, this, this. What? She gasped in his ear as she pulled him down to her.
All of this, he whispered.
I love you, she whispered. The knife, he thought, turning his head for air. Other than the boy, it was the one connection to him. When she was asleep and the sky beginning to lighten, he crept from the house, hurrying to the end of the puddled street where the woods began. He carried a bag and rags to clean the blade. Blue Mooney initialed the sign-out sheet for the 75 retreads he'd just loaded on his truck. Waiting on his dashboard was a cup of steaming hot coffee and a jelly donut.
Hey, Mooney, Coulter called as he headed out of the office. See if they got any extra snows up there, and if so, grab 'em.
Yes, sir,
Mooney answered with a brisk nod. Coulter's weather-beaten face softened with a grin. Both for his boss's benefit and for the ritual it had become, Mooney walked around his truck and gave the two chains securing the tires one last yank. He flipped his keys in the air with a quick glance back at the platform where Coulter was talking to one of his salesmen. That might not be a bad life, he thought, noting the salesman's shirt and tie, the shoe shine, yes, and a girl like Alice Vermoyle waving goodbye every morning.
Blue?
A familiar voice inquired. He spun around to see Sonny Stoner getting out of his cruiser with one of his cops, Jimmy Hines.
What do you want? What are you doing here?
He asked. Coulter had to be watching.
Roll up your sleeves, Sonny said. Okay, now let me see your hands. Hold them up. Why? What do you want?
He kept asking as Sonny examined his hands and arms.
Where'd you get those cuts? What cuts? I don't know, I always got cuts.
He looked at his hands. Just old nicks and scratches.
Someone broke into Marco's pharmacy last night.
Sonny's blue eyes swam over him.
Yeah, so?
He said, pulling down his sleeves and trying to button the cuffs. His hands were shaking. No, no, Coulter was heading down the ramp.
They broke a cellar window to get in, Sonny said.
And they must have cut themselves because we found blood.
Well, it sure as hell wasn't me, Chief.
He ignored Hines.
Look. These are dirty old cuts. Where were you last night? You going to tell me this time? Because now I'm going to have to start looking beyond certain things. Now I got to go on my instincts, Blue. And my instincts tell me you're heading out of control. I was at my mother's.
Oh, yeah, Jimmy Hines snorted. Sure.
He kept pacing back and forth behind Stoner.
All night?
All night.
Jimmy, go get Hildy Copper.
She ain't there now.
You said...
I stayed there last night. She said I could, only she and my brothers went to Saratoga. Hey, Sonny, how you doing?
Coulter said as they shook hands.
What's going on?
He looked at Blue.
I just got to talk to him for a minute, Jake, in private if you don't mind.
Is there some kind of problem?
Coulter asked. Sonny gave Blue a quick look.
Nothing I can't handle, Jake.
Well, that's good to hear,
Coulter said, smiling, though his flinty eyes shot from face to face.
Blue's a good worker. One of these days I'm going to hate like hell losing him to the core.
Hines rocked back on his heels and chuckled.
I wouldn't worry about it, Mr. Coulter.
Jimmy,
warned the chief, but the words had already met the air.
Seeing as how they drummed him out.
The three men stood there looking at one another.
What's he talking about, Blue?
Coulter asked. But he couldn't answer. Arms at his sides, head up, gaze level, jaw clenched, he did not, could not, dared not move or speak. As Howard Menke came down the street early in the morning with his landlady, Lucille, he saw the rectory door fly open. Unshaven and red-eyed,
Father Gannon was fastening his clerical collar as he ran toward the church, late again for Mass. Howard felt bad. He usually tried to wake Father Gannon up in time, but he'd taken the day off. Today was a special day. He and Lucille were on their way to the depot. He tried not to walk too fast. The first bus to Burlington left in 20 minutes. He and Josiah always got to the depot an hour early. Waiting was half the fun. They'd buy candy bars from the vending machines and eat them on the bench in front of the door where they sat watching the buses come and go with all their passengers. But Lucille said her nerves were in a bad way, and she didn't want to sit in a depressing terminal any longer than she had to. He'd been both pleased and bewildered to find her so dressed up this morning. She wore a white dress, a big black picture hat, and white high heels that made her walk funny, like her pants were wet, he thought. The excitement of planning a trip was one thing, but he could see that for Lucille, actually taking one was something else. At her worst, Josiah had never been this snappish. "I hope this cousin of yours isn't all stuck up," she huffed, trying to keep pace with him.
"No, she's not," he said. "I hope we don't get there and she's too sick for company."
She kept stopping to straighten her hat. She peered up at him. "I forgot her name again.
Purda. Purda Menka."
As they started walking, he glanced down at those wobbly high heels. He didn't dare tell her that when they got to Waterbury, it was still a 2-mile hike from the bus stop to the hospital, mostly uphill.
"And what's Purda's problem? You never really said."
She made a face as if nothing could possibly warrant all this effort.
"I don't know for sure. She's just always been that way."
"What way?"
"Sick."
"How sick?"
She rolled her eyes.
"Well, let me see. She can't get out of bed, and she don't talk, I know that."
He turned back to see where she was. She had stopped dead in the middle of the sidewalk, her hands on her hips.
"What do you mean she don't talk?"
He shrugged.
"I don't know. She just don't."
"So what are we going to do? Just sit and watch her?"
"We talk to her, me and Josiah, that is. We tell her things, things we've been doing, things we've seen. And there's all the others,"
he tried to explain.
"Some of them talk, and they like us," he grinned.
She didn't say anything. She just looked at him, and all of a sudden he got this funny feeling as if his limbs had turned to stone. Everything. Walking, carrying the lunch bag and the gift bag, even counting out the money for the 2 round-trip tickets, took such energy that by the time they were seated on the bus, he was so tired that he fell into a strange half-sleep. He was distantly aware of the wheels turning under them, the stench of exhaust through the dusty sliding windows, and beside him, the wet crunch of Lucille's pointy teeth into a pair. And all the while, both awake and asleep, he dreamed. He dreamed of walking across the ice pond with Josiah on their way home from school. In his dream, Josiah took his hand and they began to glide, their big black boots suddenly smooth as skate blades. Then he dreamed of hammering, pounding nails into wood, while the Monsignor kept calling him. The Monsignor needed repairs done, but first he had to finish this enormous crucifix. Now he dreamed of Purda, the dream so real he could smell the stale pee in the ward as he and Lucille squeezed through the narrow space between the beds. When they got to Purda's side, Lucille pinched her nose. He told her she'd get used to it.
"Well, that's her,"
he said of the curled form under the sheet. Her kinky red hair, uncut since his last visit, spread over the pillow. Josiah usually trimmed it, but today he would do it.
"Purda," he whispered, "I brung somebody new. Turn over, Purda, just for a minute."
She turned, and the long red hair fell back from the gleaming, bloated face, the deep-socketed, dead eyes staring back at him.
"Stop it! Stop that yelling! You're embarrassing me," Lucille said, shaking his arm. "They're all looking at us."
From the front of the bus to the back, heads craned over the seat, and heads poked out into the aisles to see what all the hollering was about. About $6,000, that's what Sam figured his sister owed him from his mother's trust. He had deducted expenses for whatever Helen had given him through the years for haircuts, paper, things like that, a pair of shoes a few years back, some dental bills, odds and ends, really. For good measure, he subtracted another $10 now before putting away his papers. She was barely speaking to him, or to anyone else, for that matter. As always, when life turned on Helen, she turned on her brother. She didn't call him to meals. His clothes went unwashed. Everyone in the house was sullen and miserable, except his mother, who hummed in her crib from sunrise to bedtime. Josiah crept past him in silence, her hounded eyes burrowing into her mops and rags. Reenie shuffled from room to room to avoid the inevitable confrontation between his brother-in-law and his wife. In retaliation, Sam had begun to cook his own meals, running the water minutes longer than he needed it. He spread the butter so thickly on his bread he could barely eat it, then laid the greasy knife on the tablecloth. He opened the refrigerator door countless times, wanting nothing from it but the satisfaction of hearing its motor rumble needlessly on and off. He left dirty dishes on the table, lights burning in empty rooms. When he bathed, he used 3 face cloths, 3 towels, then left the floating soap to melt in the stoppered tub. But nothing was working. Nothing he did could rouse her to the confrontation he needed so that he could throw down his calculations and demand his trust money. She ignored him. No one seemed to care one way or another that he was back. The only reason Marie had come was to badger him for the money. Not one of his children had come or even called. At odd, dragging moments, he would find himself thinking of Applegate. He thought of Marlin playing the piano, the sun-washed walls, the lush, warm flowers, the brilliant green lawns, the sturdy white backs of the attendants steering patients in wheelchairs along the bumpy stone paths, the mannered authority of the doctor's voices drifting from paneled offices down the scented hallways, and the linened table set with blue-traced china and sparkling goblets. Here in his stale room he began to miss the rising and bedtime chimes and the far-ringing call of the mealtime bells. He missed Applegate's precision, its barricade of rules and schedules that protected him from all responsibility and decision and failure. He'd forgotten what this deadening emptiness was like. He'd forgotten how freedom afflicted him with this peculiar paralysis. He could hear Josiah dragging the vacuum cleaner up the stairs. She turned it on in the hallway. His heart raced with its sucking blast. His palms were moist. Squinting, he stood at the window. The rain had lulled him through the night, but now the sun swelled through the grayness. He leaned over the sill to watch the children skipping rope down on the sidewalk. He sat back on the edge of his bed and flicked hairs off his pillow. He needed a haircut. The vacuum moved farther down the hall.
"Yes," he said in a low voice. "It's 11:30 now. I'll put on a summer shirt. Let's see. Here now, the blue one. And then I'll walk downtown to the barber. When he's not looking, I'll grab the paper and go read in the park a while. Maybe feed the pigeons some popcorn. On the way back, I'll stop by the library and get 3 books, 1 for tonight and 2 for the weekend. Then maybe I'll get a half pint of clams for clam stew tonight."
He began to feel better. Plans, that was the trick. He needed plans, things to look forward to. No long journey, just one small step after another. He tapped lightly on Helen's door.
"What is it?"
she snapped.
"I need $2 for a haircut."
"Haircut, 75 cents."
"I thought I'd get a paper and some clams for tonight," he said, grimacing with his cheek at the door.
"Tell the barber to put it on Reenie's bill," she said. "We're having smelt tonight."
He closed his eyes.
"Don't make me crawl, Helen."
"You crawled back here, didn't you?"
Now was the moment to throw open the door and demand what was rightfully his. But he wasn't ready. It wasn't the right time. He came down the stairs. On the street, the jump rope stilled as the little girls watched him pass. The world smelled of grass clippings. He squinted under the hazy sun at people he had known for years, some all his life. They nodded uneasily, hurried on. "That's all right," he assured himself, light-headed on the first leg of this shaky voyage into his new life. It was just a simple walk downtown. What was there to fear? After all, he was sober and he had plans. Plans just like these people had. The trick was to stay focused, to keep himself small and so tightly bound that the dead space could not get bigger, because if it did, it would engulf him. A cold sweat rose on his back. Deep breaths now, in and out. There, that's the trick. The closer he got to the bustle of the downtown streets, the more unnerved he became. He had no money, nothing to do, not even a dime for a cup of coffee. No, he'd make it work. He had to put himself together. Once, in the middle of group therapy, Litchfield had asked if there was anything or anyone in his life for whose sake he'd be willing to die.
"A drink,"
he'd said,
as much to jab Litchfield as to make the other patients laugh.
"Then you, Sam Fermoil," Litchfield had said disgustedly, "are your own meager invention."
Now, as he neared the flat-roofed stores at the bottom of the hill, he tried to remember when he had not been poor Sammy, the gutless but witty Sammy, that lazy, no-good Sammy, who had spent a lifetime seeking and fleeing the smothering breast of his mother's need and love, his father's morose attention, his sister's resentment, and somehow settling for a vantage point of weakened pity that not only served him well, but satisfied their thirst for his thin blood. Even his wife and children had succumbed, finding refuge in his failure. If Alice did not go to college, it was his fault. If Benji was afraid of his own shadow, it was his fault. If Norm was a brawler, it was his fault.
"I am all things to all people," he murmured through a forced smile.
The record store was playing stringed music through a speaker over its doorway. A high-heeled woman rustled past him. Little boys huddled around the bench where their baseball cards were laid out in rows according to teams. He stopped to watch. They glanced up at him, then resumed their argument about Whitey Ford's earned run average. He dug his fingers into the lint in his pockets. He felt shabby and useless. People strode by, resolute in their missions, shopping bags in hand, keys and coins, the minutiae of their successes, jingling with every step. He followed them, matching their brisk gait, their frowning concentration. He walked behind a thin-shouldered man half his age and trailed him up Merchant's Row, silently addressing the back of his head.
"I also have places to go and books to pick out and people to visit. Even on these narrow streets, I know hundreds of people who, if they see me, will call to me and beg me to come inside. In high school, I wrote a paper on the Proctor Marble Company that the Atkinson Crier printed. My junior year, I was a starting pitcher with a curveball no one could hit. They said I was going places. They did, believe it or not."
The young man turned the corner at West Street, and Sam turned with him.
"Right here, on this very corner, there was an accident. I was on my way home from school. The car burst into flames, and I helped the firemen lay down their hoses. The hair on the back of my hands was singed. My mother said..."
The young man went into the paint store. Sam watched the closing door.
"Pathetic, isn't it?" he murmured with a bitter chuckle.
"High school, my mother."
It ended there. After that came failure and degradation. He continued walking until he came to Rini's store, where a pyramid of dusty fans was displayed in the front window. A faded newspaper clipping was taped to the glass. "The Fan Man," said the headline over Rini's picture. He had started to read the article the day it came out, but then had been too embarrassed for Rini to continue. Rini's face glowed hopefully with the opening door, then darkened as Sam approached the counter.
"Hey, Rini, you've really fixed this dump up nice. I like the walls yellow like that. Brightens it up,"
Rini murmured, then looked back down at his open ledger.
"I'll say."
"Hot day,"
Rini said without looking up.
"I'll say."
"Muggy,"
Rini said.
"You can say that again."
Sam tugged at his collar. He watched Rini's fingers grip the pencil stub and draw a heavy line through a row of figures.
"How's business?"
"Could be worse,"
Rini sighed.
"Could be better, huh?"
Rini looked up suspiciously. He closed the green book and laid his hand flat on its cover. He took a deep breath.
"Look, Sam, if it's money you want..."
Sam raised his hand to silence him.
"Nope. Just a friendly visit to my favorite brother-in-law."
He bent to look at the pictures taped to Rini's cash register, annoyed to see they were his children. Rini smiled.
"You know these walls, this color, this yellow? Alice was the one that picked that out."
"Well," he chuckled, "what can I say? She's got good taste, just like her old man."
Rini's pride over his kids had always irritated him.
"She's a nice girl," Rini said, grinning. "I got her that job, you know, up to the A plus X. I know she didn't want it, but you know Marie, how strict she is with the kids. She called me and she said, 'I don't want her at the lake, I want her home.' So I called him, the guy up there, that Coughlin, and I said, 'You know that walk-in cooler repair, that job I did, that bill I've been after? Well, you give my niece Alice a job, and then we're even.'"
Rini gave a sheepish shrug.
"Of course, I never told Marie all of it. I learned that about her. She's a very proud woman."
"Is that so?"
Sam said. His brother-in-law was still thick as a post.
Oh, yeah. With her, you gotta be so careful.
I'll remember that.
Yeah. Like Norm's job, I must have called Alderman Green 100 times anyway. So then one day the town clerk comes in, you know, Bill Sheets, and he wants one of them meat grinders there. For you, Mr. Sheets, I says, that's 20% off. Only catch is, I got a real fine nephew that needs a summer job, and just like that, Sheets says, send him down to Jardin Green. But of course, I never tell Marie the part about the discount. She's funny about that stuff. It's her pride, I can tell.
Sam ground his teeth. Was the dumb bastard trying to rub his nose in it?
You seen Norm yet?
Reenie asked.
No, not yet. Wait till you see him. You're gonna be so amazed. He's got these big muscles like this.
Reenie's fingertips formed a circle.
His neck. He's just really filled in like a man. You know, the job, all the hard work, and the heavy labor.
Reenie, that reminds me, he said, touching the back of his neck. I was thinking of getting a haircut. You got a buck you can sport me?
No, Sam, I don't, as a matter of fact. I just made a deposit.
The little ring-eyed grunt was obviously lying. He didn't want it to be his buck that knocked Sam off the wagon. A door creaked open at the back of the store, and Reenie spun around. A large cat strutted toward them, then jumped onto the counter. Reenie looked from Sam to the cat.
That's Tom, he said with stricken eyes.
Nice to meet you, Tom, Sam said, nodding at the purring cat.
He's a nice cat.
Reenie stroked its neck.
Well, that's good. Helen don't know Tom's here.
Where does she think he is? He was confused by Reenie's obvious alarm.
I mean, she don't know anything about Tom. I didn't tell her.
He stared at Sam.
So you keep a little pussy on the side. Big deal.
He laughed, but Reenie didn't get it.
I just didn't want her to hear about it. I just didn't.
Hear about what? And the minute he said it, he knew Reenie meant his old dog Riddles. Reenie didn't want to endure her old complaints about Riddles, about his deceit. Reenie had said the dog had just followed him home one night. She claimed he had lured the dog home with him. Riddles had lived in the shed off the back porch. Whenever Helen went shopping or to church, Reenie would carry the stocky red dog into his bedroom, where he'd spend the furtive hour laughing and talking to Riddles until she came home, breathing into the back of her gloved hand, insisting she could smell dog in the house. One day, Riddles disappeared. Helen said the real owners probably took it back. Reenie said Riddles ran away because he was a hunting dog and not a house dog. But when he said it, he had gotten this same sheepish look, because he must have known it was a lie. Reenie began to rearrange a display of juice makers. He had on the same dark plaid shirt and brown tie he always wore. Poor bastard, Sam thought. Let somebody else tell him that Helen had paid Howard Menke to poison the dog. He couldn't bring himself to. The cat jumped down behind the counter and lapped milk from a blue soup bowl Sam recognized as part of his mother's china. The Fermoil legacy had come to this. He thought of Marie. He cleared his throat and asked Reenie what he knew about Omar Duval. His first night home, in the middle of her tirade, Helen had told him that Marie was going out with a trashy-looking man by that name. Reenie said he'd only met Duval one time. Duval had tried to interest him in some soap-selling scheme. He suggested using the soap as a promotional tool, a free 10-pound box of detergent with every washing machine. When Reenie said he couldn't afford to do that, Duval had explained that the thing to do was to jack up the price of the washing machine enough to cover each box. Reenie said he didn't think that would work, not with the big new Montgomery wards opening up on Route 4. Well, then, just sell the soap, then, Duval had suggested. He could even keep it out back, sell it on the side. No wasted shelf space, no advertising, just tell his customers what a great buy it was. And that way, Duval had said, it could all be under the table, nothing on the books, no trouble like he'd had before with the IRS and the cash sales.
So right then, when he said that, I don't know, I got suspicious.
Reenie stepped close to Sam and looked around, though they were the only ones in the store.
I think he's really a tax agent, that's what I think. I could tell the way he was looking around. He just knew too much about what was going on here.
Reenie looked around again.
You maybe ought to warn Marie there's something fishy going on.
Not much gets by you, does it, Reenie? You've always got your finger right there on the pulse of things. He leaned on the counter. Hey,
I'll bet you know something about my mother's trust fund for me.
Nothing. I don't know nothing.
Rini shook his head and this time held the shrug with upturned hands.
Don't give me that shit,
he snapped. Rini did this to him.
I got nothing to do with any of that, Rini said, the color in his face draining as he eyed a long black Lincoln that was parking in front of the store. Ask Helen.
I'll ask Helen. I'll ask her, goddammit.
He pounded the counter, and the cat darted toward the cellar door.
There's a customer coming, Rini warned, as a tall, slim woman emerged from the Lincoln.
I don't give a shit who's coming. Sam!
The bells on the opening door rang, and Sam moved to the back of the store. He opened a refrigerator and peered inside. The woman wore a red and white polka-dot dress. She carried a toaster under her arm as she marched up to Rini. She banged the toaster down, dislodging crumbs and charred raisins onto the counter.
It's defective. This morning the toast never popped up, and it burned so bad that now my ceiling's stained.
Rini was still staring at the crumbs when the woman flung down a receipt. Rini picked it up and read it closely.
I want my money back, every penny.
The toaster's a year old, Rini said. It only had a 90-day warranty. I'm sorry.
Sorry? You're sorry? My ceiling's ruined and that's all you can say is you're sorry?
I could give you a new one, Mrs. Hines, Rini said with a weak gesture toward the shelf of toasters behind him.
Sam peered down the length of the store. Nora Cushing. He hadn't seen her in years.
All I want is my money back, she insisted.
She hadn't changed a bit, Sam thought. The Cushing fortune, and still tight-fisted with every penny and just as bitchy as ever.
Look at them, Rini pleaded. Take anyone you want, Mrs. Hines. You got your pick.
I don't think you understand. It's the principal here. It's not the toaster. I mean, my lord, Dad's getting the golden toasty line in the store, so it's not as if I need one of these, she said with a flip of her hand.
You what? Sam remembered her gasping 18 years ago. You married her? You married Marie Lassau? My lord, you can't be serious.
Rini was staring at her. The golden toasty line? You mean the toasters? You're going to sell them?
Yes. So it's not the toaster, you see, it's the principal.
Are you sure about that? Rini interrupted.
What are you suggesting, that I'm trying to finagle something here? She sputtered.
I think you better check, Mrs. Hines. I don't think Cushing's is getting the golden toasty line.
The laughter rose from deep in her throat.
Well, we are, but that's beside the point.
Nora,
Sam called, coming toward her now.
Nora Cushing.
Oh, Sam.
She glanced at Rini, then back at Sam.
Oh, I'm so embarrassed.
How've you been?
He asked, conscious of his frayed cuff as they shook hands.
Well, I guess I'm a little worked up, she said, gesturing toward Rini, whose whole body seemed to have caved in on itself. It was just such an awful morning. I was busy with Bernard. He's been very sick, you know.
Sam nodded. He had heard that Nora's son had some terrible illness.
But then smoke from the burned toast got all through the house, and it just seemed like there wasn't anything I could do about anything anymore except this, the toaster.
She grabbed it from the counter and held it.
Rini, what can I say? I'm sorry. I'm really embarrassed.
Rini stared at her with bright, wet eyes. His mouth twitched.
See, Rini understands,
Sam had to say when Rini still did not speak.
You're going through a lot right now.
Oh, God. She sighed. It's just been so awful.
She sniffed and wiped her nose on the back of her wrist. Her perfume smelled of roses and wrinkled dollar bills. Her tanned skin and smooth black hair looked expensive. Even under the store's dim lights, her necklace and bracelets and rings glittered. She had begged him to marry her. Marie Lassau could go to a home somewhere and have the baby. She'd even pay for it herself. It wasn't a real marriage, Nora had argued, because she was just a child who had set out to trap him. They could have it annulled. Between her father, who was a Knight of Malta, and her cousin, Father Burke, they had plenty of connections to the Vatican.
I can't,
he'd said to every entreaty. Can't. Could not. Would not. Why, she'd demanded. They had been engaged for over a year. Her mother's parlor had been filled with gifts.
Why? Because he loved her. Loved skinny little Marie Lassau more than he had ever loved anyone.
Had that been it, he wondered now. Had it been that simple? when all these years he had regarded it as a symptom of his failed life, a coward's way out, one more heinous escape. How grateful Nora must be now. 18 years ago she had wept hysterically in her father's car as she stabbed her wrist with a nail file.
How could you do this to me? How could you? How could you? How could you humiliate me with someone like her?
It's leukemia, she whispered. We've brought him everywhere. Her eyes shone with tears as she recounted the history of her son's illness, the easy bruising and painful joints she had blithely ascribed to growing pains, the shocking diagnosis, the bewilderment, the unfairness of it all. He was their only child, just 15 years old, a brilliant student, a gifted pianist. Reenie blew his nose into his handkerchief. Sam ran his fingers through his hair, a sad smile fixed against this sudden urge to push her out of his way and run up the street. She touched his arm, then reached suddenly into her pocketbook, pawing through it with the same intensity with which she had searched that night for her nail file. She pulled out a photograph of her son and handed it to him. He said the boy looked like his father. Yes, she nodded, he did. She asked about his children, taking deep breaths, smelling rich again, her pinched, brave smile attesting to the blind injustice that would rob her of her one and only stellar child, while the ragtag kids of a loser like Sam from Oil were spared. Is it true about Alice being interested in the convent? She asked, patting her smudged eyeliner with a pale blue tissue.